In this next segment, we will continue to examine the central bank's role in this entire crisis, because over the past 50 years, the central banks have become more and more powerful. So we will examine their role as well as the economic drivers behind this crisis. So we welcome panelists Catherine Austin Fitz and Professor Richard Verner. Catherine Austin Fitz is the president of Solari Inc., publisher of the Solari Report, and managing member of Solari Investment Advisory Services. Catherine served as managing director and member of the board of directors of the Wall Street investment bank Dillon, Reed & Company, as an assistant secretary of housing and federal housing commissioner at the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development in the Bush administration, and was the president of Hamilton Securities Group. She graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton School, and studied Mandarin Chinese at the Chinese University, Hong Kong. Our next guest is Professor Richard Verner. Professor Verner is a former investment banker and university professor in banking and finance. He holds a first-class honors degree in economics from the London School of Economics and a doctorate in economics from the University of Oxford. He is a founding chair of Local First, a community interest company establishing not-for-profit community banks. Professor Verner's book, Princes of the Yen, was number one bestseller in Japan. In 1995, he proposed a new monetary policy he called quantitative easing, a concept that has become very popular among the central bankers. So I want to welcome both of you to the conference. Professor Verner, I will begin with you. For more than 5 years now, you have been warning that the central banks are waging war against cash and against banks as they prepare to launch their own digital currencies. So how do the regulations to control the spread of COVID-19 advance the central bank's efforts to create their own digital currency?
Well, thanks for having me. Am I on?
I think so.
Okay, I can hear you.
Because we're on. Go ahead.
Okay, excellent. well, I can hear Taylor twice and myself once with a lag, so it is kind of hard to know who to respond to. Everyone has several appearances with a lag here on my screen.
I can hear you, Richard.
Yes, and I can see you twice.
Ah, sorry about that.
And once with a lag, which is kind of confusing. Can you just repeat the question?
Taylor, can you repeat the question?
Yes, absolutely. So I was saying, Professor Verner, that for more than 5 years, you have been warning that central banks are waging war against cash and against banks as they prepare to launch their own digital currencies. So how do the regulations to control the spread of COVID-19 advance the central bank's efforts to create their own digital currency?
Well, the central banks have been working towards the centralization of the monetary system that's unprecedented in world history. Until very recently, we've had the development that more banks had been created and the banking system had become more and more diversified. However, in the last 50 years, roughly, as central banks have become more and more independent from governments and more powerful, we've observed also that policies have been taken that serve to centralize the monetary system. And it seems, in a nutshell, that the policies taken since roughly March 2020 under the flag of a virus pandemic have been accelerating that agenda that had been in place for quite a while. And that is taking a number of dimensions, although the result is centralization in many parts of the economy, in the monetary system, in the payments mechanisms, and also in terms of decision making. And also the diversity of players, because clearly policies taken have created a major setback for big parts of the economy that will find it hard to participate in the future.
Now, Catherine, welcome to the stream. I wanted to ask you, what are some of the privacy and security concerns with a digital currency operated by the central banks?
So there's several concerns, Taylor, that we have. And we have to first look at what is happening with the Going Direct plan. And that is, very simply, we have used a health crisis as an excuse to shut down the small business and many parts of the economy. At the same time, the central bankers are printing money in a way that that the people who get that money can turn around and buy assets cheap. Think of this as disaster capitalism in a way that's unprecedented. So you shut down Main Street's economy and proceed to force everybody into the stocks and the companies you own. So we are watching a dramatic increase in inequality, because basically this is a leverage buyout by the people who I would say own the central banks and the top 1% of society. So this is engineered inequality, and we've experienced engineered inequality for quite a while. Now, what is the danger? If you combine vaccine passports, which is really a way of getting a digital ID card that can dovetail with the CBDC system, what we're talking about is a complete digital control system. It's the end of currencies as we know it on the retail level. And what it means is that if the central bankers, as Mr. Carson's explained to you, don't want you spending money more than 5 kilometers from your home, or they don't want you buying pizza, you can't do it. They have complete control of how you can transact. Now, why is this important? One of the reasons it's important is, for over a century in the Western world, in the G7, we've had a balance of power between the central banks and the electorate. The electorate votes for the legislatures, who determine fiscal policy, and the central banks basically determine monetary policy, and there's a balance of power. What we're looking now is a debt entrapment of the sovereign governments and the central bankers taking control of the treasuries through the back door, including through the debt, and an end of democracy and any representation by the electorates. If we use CBDCs, then the central bank can simply take taxes from our accounts. So we know that the World Economic Forum has said it's 2030, you have no assets and you'll be happy. What you know, you have no assets means is, if we have a digital control system, we can in fact take all your assets.
Professor Werner, let's speak more broadly on this issue. How would you characterize the economic policies implemented since March 2020? And this includes the restrictions and lockdowns, as well as public money injections into the economy.
Well, the policies undertaken are completely unprecedented for Western democracies, or what we thought were Western democracies. As it turns out, perhaps they aren't actually Western democracies anymore, because parliaments seem to have ceased operation for all means and purposes. Some kind of takeover seems to have taken place. For what we see is actually only paralleled when we study much more totalitarian regimes such as the Soviet Union. And it is probably fair to say that we've witnessed, under the guise of some, you know, apparently reasonable justification, some people think, the Sovietization of our societies in a process that started by restricting individual freedoms, and that included shutting down entire industrial sectors. And that seems to proceed with measures and the preparation of also future measures that cannot but facilitate further fairly totalitarian control mechanisms. And that includes, of course, now the latest technologies such as digital passports under various guises and justifications. And as we heard from the head of the BIS, the central bank, digital passports and wallets have one thing in common, that they give a lot of knowledge, a lot of power and control into the hands of those who operate those mechanisms. And these are central planners whose powers have increased in a completely unprecedented fashion in the last year since March 2020. Now, some people say that these policies are going to result in inflation and perhaps even hyperinflation. And of course, a year ago, I warned about inflation appearing. This is now visible and has come to pass. There is a concern that we're going to get hyperinflation. But at the moment, it looks like the money creation by the central banks and banking systems have been rolled back a little bit. So in my view, the hyperinflation scenario has been delayed in the short term. But of course, it's still on the cards. On the other hand, we shouldn't forget that in a Sovietized economy, there can also be price controls. Certainly, the indicators of prices and inflation, consumer price indices, are very much managed and controlled and engineered indices that themselves can be operated in such a way that inflation may be understated. This wouldn't be the first time in history. And so we always have to keep in mind this the Soviet model, which seems to be very, very popular in the West, for instance, in the European Union and other places.
Now, you coined the term quantitative easing. So can you please explain to the viewers what that is and how it relates to the COVID-19 response?
Quantitative easing is a policy I proposed originally in 1995 when I was in Japan. And this policy was aimed at helping post-banking crisis countries, such as at the time Japan, to emerge very quickly from a post-banking crisis type of recession and have a very strong and quick recovery. As you can tell, with Japan being in recession for over two decades, those policies were not actually adopted as I'd recommended. But the concept of the central bank expanding the money supply in a new way, in a quantitative way, as I'd suggested, the fundamental idea was very popular with central banks. Unfortunately, they misused and abused the concept because a central aspect of my original quantitative easing proposal was to expand bank credit creation, because banks are actually the money creator, and bank credit creation, bank lending, is what creates new purchasing power in the economy. And it's very important who gets this newly created purchasing power. That's shown in my quantity theory of disaggregated credit, also known as the general quantity theory. When bank credit creation is used for productive business investment, implementing new technologies and increasing productivity, you will get economic growth and no inflation. But if bank credit creation is used for just consumption, you've got the same amount of goods and services, and you've got more consumption, more purchasing power, therefore you're going to get consumer price inflation. That one scenario is the one that traditional economics focuses on without looking at the other two possibilities. And the third scenario is when bank credit creation is used simply for purchasing new assets. And then, of course, you're driving up asset prices. And that creates asset inflation, which is unsustainable. That creates the essentially the seeds for the next banking crisis, because the story will only continue while banks continue to create more money to purchase even more assets, driving up asset prices further. But the moment this musical game stops, bank credit creation for asset purchases slows or stops, then asset bubbles will end and they will burst. And then you move into the reverse scenario where asset prices fall. The late coming speculators will have capital losses, and banks will start to have non-performing loans as the speculators go bankrupt. Banks will then reduce lending even further, and that will reduce asset prices further until banks will simply reduce total lending, including for the economy and for productive business investment. You get a broad-based recession. So in that sort of scenario, you can very quickly solve the problem by the central bank stepping in, doing three things. Purchasing the non-performing assets from the banks at face value, moving them from the bank balance sheet to the central bank balance sheet. And secondly, expanding bank credit creation through a number of measures that the central bank can implement. And thirdly, the government can increase bank credit creation directly by stopping the issuance of government bonds and borrowing from commercial banks. These policies could have been implemented in Japan, then we wouldn't have had 20 years of recession. They could have been implemented in Europe when we had the massive recessions in Greece and Spain. In fact, in Greece, still ongoing. You know, that's another lost decade. Could have been ended very quickly if the central banks had expanded bank credit creation. Now, what's the link to the current COVID policies? Well, they've also increased bank credit creation, but to a larger extent for unproductive purposes, for asset purchases. So the asset price bubbles continue in the stock markets, also property markets like in Germany getting red hot. And also the bank credit creation has increasingly, and this is new since March 2020, been used for consumption as government guarantees were given to individuals and companies to borrow from banks. And an increasing amount of this newly created money has found its way into consumption. While at the same time, of course, governments have shut down a number of sectors which are supply-side constrained, so that with more demand pressure and less supply due to the supply restrictions, which are artificial imposed by governments, you cannot help but get inflation. So that explains why we've had the inflation that's presently visible. And it's now very interesting. It's going to be crucial to see what will happen next. It's a policy decision. One could end all these problems and go back to the path of sustainable growth, high growth, or through bank credit creation for productive purposes without inflation and without asset bubbles and banking crises. Or we could see more of what we've seen in the past decades, central planners essentially creating boom-bust cycles and using the recessions and downturns in order to implement further structural transformations of the system. Of course, presently and since the changes last year, 2020, it's become clear that the structural transformation continues to be a key goal, a great reset of the economy, society, even political systems, and certainly financial and international financial arrangements seem to be very much on the mind of policymakers. So the redesign of the domestic and international financial architecture is a key topic, and perhaps we should talk a bit more about that.
Absolutely, and we will get into that and your efforts just a little bit later. But first, Catherine, I would like you to weigh on an issue that we discussed a little bit earlier. How do you characterize the government's response to what it deems a public health issue?
So the governments, Taylor, no longer have information sovereignty or financial sovereignty. So if you're the President of the United States, you're deeply dependent on the central banks to buy your treasuries and continue the financing of the operation, unless you decide to issue currency yourself, which politically you're not currently in a position to do. So you're highly dependent on the banks, and then you're highly dependent on the owners of the media and the people who are getting fantastically wealthy. If you look at the going direct reset as a plan to centralize control, it's phenomenally successful. So from their vantage point, it's working. The other problem you have if you're a government leader is you don't have information sovereignty. You can't get on the telephone and make a call without the intelligence agencies and a variety of other people, you know, having the data and knowing what you're doing. So the government officials are very much in a corner politically, and they don't have the population's support to take the actions they need to get out of this trap. And in part, it's, as we heard in the last session, the populations really believe, or enough of people in the populations believe, that there really is a pandemic as a healthcare crisis instead of essentially a coup d'etat. So we're dealing with healthcare tyranny and financial tyranny, and to understand them both And to reverse them, we need to integrate our understanding of both together. But we also need more people in the population to understand that if you look at where they're going together, they're going into a central control, which is the end of democracies in the West as we know it, and a world where I would describe, if you look at where Carson's wants to take us, we will be slaves.
Hopefully we can obviously provide some solutions here, which brings me to my next question. Professor Verner, you are also involved with establishing and supporting community banks. Is this an alternative to the proposed paradigm of the central bank digital currencies?
Yes, I think essentially we have to strive to operate in the opposite direction from the central planners who want further centralization of all decision making. But really what we should do and what is good for ordinary people, what's good for the economy, what's good for resilience, what's good for avoiding further crises is if we have a decentralized economic structure. And that means very much based on local communities, on independent local, both suppliers and demand groups, so communities that that are resilient and self-sustainable. They can cooperate with other communities, but in many ways are locally, you know, resilient and to some extent self-sufficient. Then they won't be affected if there are problems in other parts of the economy. And we've seen this time and again, that whenever systems become more and more centralized, as the degree of centralization increases, the susceptibility of the system to shocks increases. Because when something is very, very centralized, you just need one shock to shut down everything, because it's all under one centralized chain of command, if you want. Whereas if you have very decentralized systems, a shock will just affect one part of the economy, but cannot affect the rest of the economy. And community banks provide a very powerful mechanism to ensure that this can be achieved, because they are essentially like little central banks. You know, it's like, if you have a community bank in one area, then it's like having your own local central bank that not only facilitates payments and is an intermediary in a certain economic sense, but is also the creator of new purchasing power, and therefore ultimately the creator of new wealth, net new wealth creation for a community that is not based on transferring purchasing power from other parts of the economy, but is a net new addition. And then technologies, new ideas, new projects can be implemented without taking away from anywhere else, and without inflation, you will enable the implementation of such new ideas and the generation of wealth that comes from this. And again, this is shown in my quantity theory of disaggregated credit. And the mechanism to achieve this is a very, very decentralized banking system. Now, we've seen this in history, that whenever countries decide to establish hundreds or even thousands of new banks and get a very, very decentralized banking system, that's when economic growth really takes off. And we can go back to the industrial revolution in Britain, with Scotland establishing lots and lots of small community banks, and then England doing the same, English economic growth really taking off. And next we saw that Germany and the US created thousands and thousands of community banks, and economic growth has been strong for the last 200 years in these two countries for that very reason. Another good example is, of course, Japan, which also created hundreds of small banks, local banks, specialized banks, regional banks, secondary regional banks, credit unions, and so on. And then in 1978, we have the classic example. This is when Chairman Mao had essentially left the scene, and his successors have been sort of fighting who's going to take over. And in 1978, it was Deng Xiaoping who rose to prominence, and he changed policies. And a key policy that he adopted was to establish literally thousands of new banks, small banks, medium-sized banks, big banks, specialized banks, regional banks, local banks, credit unions, savings banks, thousands and thousands of banks. And what did economic growth do? Well, economic growth just really took off, and we've had 4 decades of double-digit economic growth since, lifting more people out of poverty than at any other time in history. So it's been phenomenal. And so we have these eras of very decentralized banking systems based on small banks lending to small companies, because you see big banks lend to big companies, small banks lend to small companies. So if you don't have small banks, you won't get lending to SME, small and medium-sized enterprises. And they're the main employer in all economies in the world. Small firms account for 70% of employment almost everywhere. And if they don't get funding, you don't get economic growth. And if you have many, many small banks in a decentralized system, you get resilience, you get job creation in the small firm sector, and you get high economic growth. So there's many, many benefits, but it also addresses this problem that we currently experience of excessive centralization, as central planners think it's more efficient to centralize, when the truth is actually the opposite. Ultimately, it's more efficient to decentralize.
And this all ties in really well with our next segment of the evening.